Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of the DVD Marquee. Remember us? I'm Jeff Rosato, and with me is...
Stan Williams, and welcome to the podcast of the future.
That's right, man. Hear those goofy sound effects? Yep. That's in keeping with our first movie on the show, which is called Forbidden Planet, and we'll be getting into that movie, the two-disc special edition, here in just a moment. We've also got John Tucker Must Die, American Dreams, Body Double, Cars, and a couple of musical titles, which I'm very excited about. I don't think we've ever discussed a musical title on the show, Stan, or at least on our shows. But anyway, we open with the 1956 sci-fi classic, Forbidden Planet.
Imagine yourself as one of the crew of this faster-than-light spaceship of the future, sharing their curiosity to know the unknown, their tension, their readiness for inconceivable adventures.
Sir, we're being radar scanned.
United Planets cruiser C-57D, J.J. Adams commanding. Who are you?
Morbius of the Bellerophon.
Well, Dr. Morbius, my orders are to survey the situation on Altair 4.
Commander, if you step down on this planet, I warn you that I cannot be answerable for the safety of your ship or your crew.
In the 1950s, the science fiction genre flourished with the likes of The Day the Earth Stood Still, The Thing, War of the Worlds, and The Incredible Shrinking Man. But the film that made the most lasting impact in this field was Forbidden Planet, a movie that influenced a generation of future filmmakers and television producers, including George Lucas, Gene Roddenberry, Steven Spielberg, and James Cameron, to name but a few. With its expansive sets, groundbreaking special effects, haunting electronical score, and intellectual storyline, it's aged extremely well and more than deserving of a two-disc special edition from the reissued Department Gods at Warner Brothers Home Video. Stan, I know you're a big fan of classic sci-fi and current-day sci-fi. What'd you think about Forbidden Planet?
Okay, first of all, I loved it, but I have to admit, I'm scarred for life. I was not prepared for the sight of Robbie the Robot telling us that he had just gotten back from giving himself an oil job. I was not expecting that. I didn't think that would make it past the code.
Scarred
for life. Look at the abuse Robbie takes in this movie. He's giving himself oil jobs,
right?
And then we have this one guy from the ship who basically turns Robbie into a still, basically.
Yeah.
But aside from those two things, actually, maybe just because of those two things, I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, it surprised me because, well, for one thing, I was never really able to get into it because you know how these wides, and we're going to talk about the look of this film in just a little bit, but you know how wide this thing is shot. It always looked to me really washed out on TV,
mm-hmm.
and to see it in this form was just, it really presented it in a new light, and it's a perfect example of why letterboxing is so important. And it has an aged look at first. You can tell it's a movie from, the 1950s and all that.
But that's what's so cool about it.
I think so. But, what really helped it out was the deep psychological storyline, great performances from a really good cast. And, it could have been a disaster in lesser hands. But,
don't forget, it really sounded like the future.
Yeah, it did. I mean, we're going to talk about the soundtrack.
Because apparently in the future, what we have to look forward to is creepy disembodied sound effects around us constantly.
Oh, you mean like this? Oh, man, psychedelic. Anyway, I'll tell you, a major advantage point was having MGM make this movie, because MGM, they were mostly known for their musicals, things like Singing in the Rain, Easter Parade, and all that, and their dramas like Mrs. Miniver, Mutiny on the Bounty. But MGM always stood for quality, and although this was like one of the few science fiction films they ever made during this period, and this may have been the first, I didn't have a lot of time to do a lot of back history research into it, but you couldn't ask for a it to be in better hands than MGM.
It's a great disc, and I mean just from a geeky technical level, the wide mm-hmm. the widescreen, the colors, all of it.
yeah, I'd like that's the ultimate recommendation.
Yeah. How long did it take you to quit giggling every time Leslie Nielsen came on screen?
I knew you were going to ask me that. About maybe 5 minutes or so.
Yeah.
But once you got into the movie,
He's great, though. I mean, it's nothing against him, but I got to admit, because apparently I'm 12.
Right.
Exactly. He was giving himself an oil job. Yeah. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I.
Welcome to Double Entendre Theater. But I'll tell you who else impressed me in this movie, not simply because she was gorgeous, but she gave a good performance, and that's Anne Francis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with every lecherous member of the crew of the rocket ship going, so, baby, you never heard of an Earth kiss? Well, let me show you. And, yeah, yeah, it kind of bordered on the creepy there after a while. It's like, yeah.
And of course, you know, who can forget that unforgettable swimming scene, you know, and Leslie was the gentleman of the group, you know, and didn't want to take advantage of her in that way. And they had a good chemistry going on. I thought that they worked really well together. And by the way, we'll get to more of the special features in a while, but Anne Francis, good Lord, she looks great, you know, for somebody being in her 70s and all that. I mean, she must have a picture of Dorian Gray in her basement. Anyway,
just all the way around. It's a classic. If you're interested in movies, I mean, the history of movies at all. I mean, and just from a geeky 50s sci-fi level, it's worth it just on that level. And it's an amazing disc. It's full of stuff. It looks
it's two
great.
Discs. It's just two discs.
Two discs. Even an episode of the Thin Man TV series featuring Robert. That's a great. Although I couldn't make it through it all the way.
But just, it was kind of cool in a 50s TV kind of way. I enjoyed that. Other extras on the disc, you've got deleted scenes, which are interesting, but in most cases they were rightly trimmed, although there are a couple that still makes fans of this film wonder if it was rushed into release because they could have really altered the storyline. Behind-the-scenes footage of the special effects shots, which show just how intricate and ambitious they were. Some are in pre-production stage, others near complete, and some show just how noisy Robbie the robot actually was. I mean, they basically, all the actors in their scenes with Robbie had to redo their dialogue, ADR, or whatever you call it, so that was interesting. You've also got a terrific nearly hour-long documentary called Watch the Skies, the 1950s, and us, featuring lengthy comments from Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Ridley Scott, and James Cameron, taking us through their memories of growing up in the 1950s and not just being surrounded by these inspiring movies, but also with the constant real-life fear of the potential deadly consequences of the Cold War, when one push of the button could have ended life on this planet as we know it. And a lot of these films, if you go back and look at it and stand, like, you know, them, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and others. These films kind of had underlying messages about nuclear threats. You know, you got these gigantic spiders, big ants, creepy aliens, either representing the bad guys or the end results of messing with things you shouldn't be messing with, to borrow a phrase from Nancy Sinatra. I've also got a terrific 30-minute documentary called The All-Amazing, exploring the reaches of Forbidden Planet that really makes up for a lack of a commentary track. Covers everything you want to know about the movie, from its origins to its place in movie history. And unlike many films in the past that have gotten special edition treatment, we're very blessed to still have some of the major players with us, like Leslie Nielsen, Earl Holliman, and Anne Francis, who still looks gorgeous. Just wanted to throw that in again. And I also love the way that they utilize the back history of the soundtrack, because this is just one of the most impressive scores I've ever heard. And you and I were talking about that earlier this evening. It was just simply fantastic. And this is one of the first uses of electronic music, and certainly some sort of primitive use of synthesizers. I was thinking about that. And sure enough, after watching the documentary, it's revealed that the electronic contraptions that they utilized were indeed precursors to what would become that equally groundbreaking musical instrument. We've got a feature about Robbie himself that answers the question, just how far away are we from having something like him in our own homes? A bunch of great trailers from classic 1950s sci-fi films, and about the only low point, a cheesy, and I do mean cheesy, 1957 sci-fi movie called The Invisible Boy that I think really had no other reason for being included than simply for the fact that it included Robbie in a supporting
role. But props to him for including it on the disc.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's silly and just, you know, it's nowhere nearly as good as the trailers for the films I just mentioned, but, you know, hey, Robbie the Robot, where can you go wrong? Picture quality, I thought it was just fantastic, Stan. There were a couple of moments that looked a little off color for me, but since this was the first time I've ever seen Forbidden Planet, I'm guessing that that was the way it was filmed. And the sound is phenomenal. You know, this sucker must have been released in some sort of stereo version when it first came out, because, you know, there's no mono version included, and it's just very wide, and that music just really, really creeps you out. And just, I thought it looked and sounded terrific.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
So
highly, highly recommended.
Definitely, definitely. If you're looking for one of the granddaddies of sci-fi films that influenced many films from Star Wars to Aliens, you need to pick up Forbidden Planet, now available in a brand new 2-disc special edition from Warner Home Video. And now for something a little more current for you youngsters out there, the teenage comedy John
Tucker
Must Die.
All right, ladies, let's play ball.
You weren't at the party last night. Where were you?
Well, it's totally on the DL. I mean, not fit to print. I'm dating John Tucker.
Hey, sorry, slipped.
Okay, all right, fine. Okay, everybody, let's play.
You know what? That was no accident.
He's mine. Stay away from him.
What?
Oh, girls, peace and love. Oh, come on.
No guys. We're fighting over this.
There's nothing to fight about. John Tucker's mine. What the hell is your problem?
I am dating John Tucker. Enough.
Okay, we pretty much have here a paint-by-numbers high school comedy, Stan, made entertaining, in my opinion, by its attractive and enjoyable cast, breezy direction by former Hill Street Blues cast member Betty Thomas, who did the original Brady Bunch movie in the Emmy Award-winning The Late Shift. And although it runs out of steam before the end, where the formerly nerdy heroine gets conflicted over whether or not her newfound popularity should come at the expense of her underlying smarts and sweetness that she started out with, I still found it...
Oh, the dilemma,
yeah. But I still found it pleasurable and entertaining, but I cannot wait to hear
You found it pleasurable?
I beg your pardon?
You found it pleasurable?
I found it pleasurable, and I take it that you didn't.
I gotta admit, I was dreading watching this movie with the white-hot intensity of 1,000 Suns.
Yeah.
But I gotta admit, the first half hour or so, I really enjoyed.
Yeah,
I was really surprised. I didn't realize Betty Thomas directed it. You're right on the money. The direction, breezy. That's actually a good word.
Thank you.
There's good direction. It's energetic. I like the cast. Unfortunately, after about half an hour, it ran out of steam pretty quick, and I got kind of bored and pretty antsy. Although, ultimately, I do have to admit, I did enjoy it more than I thought I would.
Yeah, I think a lot of people really missed out on a really enjoyable night out at the movies. And you've got four really good actresses here, particularly Ariel Keble and Brittany Snow.
They were good. It kind of reminded me, I don't know, in a weird way, the look and style kind of reminded me of Bring It On for some reason. I'm not exactly sure why. Jesse Metcalf, though, to me, has the acting ability of the microphone I'm talking into right now.
He gets
on my last nerve.
I don't want to put Jesse down too much because he's from one of my favorite shows, Desperate Housewives, where he played...
Oh, I'll put Desperate Housewives down, too.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, yeah. He played the hunky gardener. And, you know, Jesse's okay, but just, you know, for what he had to work with, I mean, you know, it was pretty much a standard part, and I thought he played it pretty well.
It was okay. I guess maybe it's a thankless role. I couldn't help wondering maybe if somebody else were in that role, if maybe it would have worked out a little better. But
so what'd you think about the non-mugging Jenny McCarthy? I thought she was quite good in
that
part.
That's another thing. I was actually kind of surprised that Jenny McCarthy actually kind of... And I don't know. I actually have sort of liked Jenny McCarthy in some of the stuff I've seen her in. But,
yeah.
And I was... I mean, we're not talking Oscar material here, but I was thinking that when I was watching it. I was like, you know, Jenny McCarthy is actually pretty good in this.
You know, it's pretty much... what you expect, but it's not as generic as some of the high school stuff I've seen as of late, high school comedy, teenage comedies, or what have you. And I think it's at least worth a rental. And the picture quality is really good, considering you've got two different versions. You've got the theatrical version and the unrated version, but it's a flipper. You've got one side is full screen and one side is letterbox. And another thing I hate about FOTS, and I don't hate FOTS. FOTS has been wonderful to us. Let me just say that out front. But just it's just in terms of the company choosing to put the extras on different sides of the disc. I thought that was really awkward. Mm. It was very strange. And
well, it's interesting you say that because that means I missed some of the extras.
Yes, you did.
I didn't even.
I thought I had left you a note about that.
I didn't even realize that. Not that I feel like I've lost anything in the process.
You didn't, Stan. I'll be honest with you. Only one of these extras really impressed me to the point of talking about it. About the only extra that I did like was the Kodiak yearbook featurette, in which we get all the main stars of the film talking about their high school days. And you were talking about Jesse Metcalf just a moment ago. Would you believe Jesse Metcalf was very quiet and almost kind of an alternative music-loving kid who changed his hair colors a lot? I mean, you would not guess that by looking at him because he's like, you know, GQ material, but just he was kind of, you know, into, you know, alternative music, you know, very quiet, you know, and Jenny McCarthy thought that her high school years were the worst years of her life.
Well, I think that guy, I think
so much for you idiots out there who didn't realize how pretty she was back then. But anyway, but that's about the only thing that I thought that was really worth mentioning. You've got some two deleted scenes which should not even have been included because they're next to nothingless. You've got a girl power featurette talking about all the ladies in the cast and how they bonded with Betty Thomas. You've got a full-length audio commentary by director Betty Thomas and editor Matthew Friedman, which sounds like Betty just got out of bed to do it. And I think there's only so much that an editor can contribute to a commentary track. It would have been great if they'd been able to have like one of the cast members to play off of. You've got Instantly Gratified, music video by People in Planes, the John Tucker Must Die dating quiz, Cut in Class with Jesse Metcalf, the on-set tour, and an On the Rebound featurette, which tells you about some of the tricks that made Jesse Metcalf look like he could play with the Denver Nuggets. So anyway, I think we're in slight agreement here, Stan. I think I enjoyed it more than you did, but you didn't think it was all that bad, right?
Well, you know, that's the thing. You have to look at it this way. This is not a movie I would have watched if I didn't have to watch it for this. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is I liked it more than I thought I would. Is that a recommendation to go out and get it? No, not at all. So take that for what it's worth.
So, you know, I guess what you're saying is rental, if you're not really into this kind of thing, and definite purchase if you enjoyed it in the theater.
Here we are, producing the most popular show on television. The show to which not only America, but now the whole world is glued. Yay! Which brings me to the task at hand. When you're on top, there's only one place to go. And where is that?
Down.
Who said that? The answer is up. Up. Because if you go down, do you know what happens? All those people who were bustering you up and smiling at you just moments ago, leap on you and kick 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 you until you shut up. Down is not an option. Let's go out there and get some great contestants. And I don't just mean talented, I mean human. And by human, I mean flawed. And by flawed, I mean freaks. Bring me some freaks. Let's make this a show that even I would watch.
You know, there's many a time when I talk to my friend Stan here about what happened on American Idol week in and week out, much to his amusement. So I'm really anxious to find out what he thinks of this next movie, which is long overdue for a review, a terrific movie, in my opinion, called American Dreams, directed by Paul Weitz, who I think also worked on American Pie and About a Boy, and several other really good films in good company. And this is probably, I really don't know how to explain this plot, but let me see if I can do it in a nutshell. Okay, you have a television show by the name of American Dreams searching for the next big pop idol in the music world, and you throw in this very Kelly Clarkson-esque female singer who's looking for every opportunity to break into show business.
Sally Kendu?
Yeah.
We're from American Dreams.
I know. And we're here to tell you...
You've been selected to perform on the show.
Why did you do that? You know what? Just once I would like to tell what... What are you doing?
I'm sorry. Screaming.
Yes, stop! Yes. Stop screaming. Stop.
Dude.
I'm really sorry. We're going to have to do this all over again. You're going to have to go inside and come out and jump for joy all over again because we didn't get it on camera.
Okay.
A very conceited, stuck upon himself host of the show.
Jessica, sweetheart. You make me feel like being a better person. And I'm not a better person. I'm me.
I feel sorry for you.
Don't. I certainly don't.
And a bumbling would-be terrorist who has an affection for show tunes. And I really can't think of anything else to say.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Bah! Luck if you've ever been a lady to begin with. Luck be a... tonight.
This is like satire at the top tier for me. I have to admit that it is a very funny, unusual, but profoundly entertaining film that managed to combine all these elements into a whole. And we haven't even talked about the president yet. This is kind of like a satire on Bush, if you think about it, the character that Dennis Quaid plays. And Stan, help me out here. I mean, this is like, I really don't know how to describe this film except to say that I enjoyed it.
I would explain it as satire with absolutely no bite. I've got to admit, I was really looking forward to this movie.
I know you were, yeah.
I love the idea. As you said, an American Idol type show where they invite the president to come on, basically
right,
to be
as a guest judge.
The president has a bit of a breakdown, decides one day he's going to start reading the paper, okay? That's as far as the joke ever really goes. There's nothing more. It's like, okay, ha-ha, the president's going to read the paper. That's a good starting point, but it goes nowhere. The American Idol stuff, the presidential stuff, there's no bite to it. I mean, I'm a big fan of satire, and I didn't think they hit their targets in a very kind of limp, underhanded kind of way.
The thing is that I think it helps if you're more into the American Idol kind of thing, like I am, mm-hmm. to see what, you know, the inner workings of that show must be like. Now, this is not to say that Simon Cowell is a complete jerk. Or, you know, that's got to be who the Hugh Grant character was based after, but it's like, you know, I tell you, Hugh Grant was terrific in this movie. I mean, I like him in likable roles, but here he was a real son of a bitch, and I enjoyed him in that aspect. I thought he was really, really good.
He was okay, but again, it's like they needed to do something more with it. I mean, okay, we all know, I mean, I don't watch American Idol, so I can't really say, but I gotta say, for a while, I was watching this movie, and I felt like I was watching an episode of American Idol because it seemed like all of a sudden stuff just quit happening. And we're watching people sing for a while, and it goes on, and it goes on. And I was really disappointed. I laughed at maybe two things. I thought the American Dreams with a Z song was kind of cute. And there was one line where Mandy Moore looks at somebody and says, "I'm sorry, but I'm not attracted to other people."
I think she's terrific in this movie.
That
as
was
well.
A great line. She was good. The cast is good. Dennis Quaid is great. It was great seeing him in a comedic role. He's fantastic.
And William Dafoe.
William Dafoe is good. Again, though, as this kind of Karl Rove type character. Again, there's just no bite to it. It's a great, great idea, but. It came across to me, I mean, when you have a concept as ludicrous as, okay, we're going to put the president on American Idol to improve his popularity ratings, you just have to do more with it. It just needed to go a lot further than it really did.
I can see your point, but I think it's a noble failure. if I have any kind of criticism of this movie at all, I think they tried to do too much with it. There were just too many competing storylines, and it may have diluted the effect that Chris Weisz, Paul Weisz, I beg your pardon, wanted to get into it. But let's talk a little bit about the extras here. The deleted scenes really don't amount to much, although there are a lot of them. Mm-hmm. I am really appreciative that they put in a lot of material that that didn't work. And there are a couple of scenes with Judy Greer, who's always been one of my favorite actresses, that I wish they had left in. You've also got Center Stage with Sally Kendu, Mandy Moore in character, taking you through the process of becoming Pop's next princess on the American Dream set. It was kind of fun in an offbeat type way. You've got, did you like Dancing Dreams? Did you learn how to boogie with the choreographer, Jennifer Lee? Did you get into that any with the White Man's Overbite?
Didn't do anything for me.
Okay, sorry about that.
Sorry.
But the best part about the features, the best feature in my opinion, was the commentary with director Paul Weitz and actor Sam Gozzari. Paul Weitz seems to me like a very nice, normal, eccentric kind of writer-director, and it was nice to get his take on things. And he was almost self-deprecating at times, mm-hmm. which I thought was really refreshing. It was like his first solo commentary, so he was a little nervous and wondering about if he should talk about this or talk about that, and I thought it was really charming.
It was. I mean, he seemed like a smart, funny guy. It was a good commentary. I guess that's part of what disappoints me. You know, I don't want to... It's not like I enjoy not enjoying the movie. You know what I'm saying? I really, really wanted to like this movie a lot more than I did.
Okay. So you're saying definitely not worth a rental, or you can't recommend it?
If you're interested in it, this is a close call for me because I like the concept so much. Mm-hmm. I just say if you're going to rent it, let's bring the expectations way down.
I think mine were way down. I think it's very entertaining in its own right, and I definitely would advise a rental, if not a purchase, but be cautious. Err on the side of caution. Okay, Stan, our next movie that we want to talk about is Body Double, directed by Brian De Palma. We thought that since Mr. De Palma has been in the movie-making news with his controversial new film, The Black Dahlia, it wouldn't be a bad opportunity to plug one of his better movies from the past.
I like to watch.
Makes you hot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Makes me hot, too. Why don't you come over here and show you how hot?
Okay.
Brian De Palma's 1984 Body Double, Bill Maher, played by Craig Wasson, follows a woman for approximately half an hour, sees a murder, and then Melanie Griffith gets naked. And that's pretty much the plot.
Yes, it is. And originally, I was going to intro that film, and I was going to say, our next movie is Alfred Hitchcock's Body Double. No, I'm sorry, Brian De Palma. Yeah, easy mistake. But, can you say ripoff? I mean, he's definitely paying homage to Hitchcock. But, that's one thing about this movie that's always bothered me. It is so obviously a modern-day retelling of Vertigo. Mm-hmm. Because
Rear Window.
Rear Window, of course, yeah. But just despite all that, I got to tell you, it's an enjoyable piece of Brian De Palma. I can't really think of any other way to describe it.
I know exactly what you mean, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
Because I'm watching this movie, and Moriarty on Ain't It Cool, ain'titcoolnews.com,
right.
A few weeks ago, was writing about this movie and how he thinks it's misunderstood and how he seems to think that people don't understand that it's a comedy. And I sort of approached watching it this time as a comedy, and it's like I can sort of see that because there are moments in this, like when he's chasing the mugger through the tunnel,
yeah.
and the claustrophobia sets in, and it's so over the top. It is so over the top.
I thought I was watching High Anxiety too. I mean, I had forgotten about that.
But there are other parts of this movie.
Anyway, go ahead.
There are other parts of the movie
that's the claustrophobia, not Melanie Griffith. But anyway, go ahead.
They're very obviously intentionally funny.
Right.
Actually, I have a theory that if you enjoy the last 10 minutes of a movie, that you will walk out of the theater, or if you're watching it at home, your memory of it is going to be that it was a good movie.
Right.
And I think that's part of my reaction to this movie there, because there's a scene, there's this very dry humor in the end, during the end credits.
Where
he's in the movie and they're doing the thing with a body double in the shower. And it's just so, you know, tongue in cheek and very, it's funny without being like, you know, in your face funny. But I don't know. There's no reason I should hate this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a scene where he follows Deborah Sheldon around for what seems like 35 minutes.
I think so, yeah.
But I liked it, and I don't know why.
And, you know, Craig Wilson is just perfect for this character, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't understand why this guy didn't become a major star, because he's just easy to like.
Well, he's hosting Real Time.
He's hosting Real Time, right. He changed his name to Bill Maher, in actuality, Craig Wilson and Bill Maher are completely different. But they may be twin sons of different mothers, so we'll do some research into that. But just, I mean, even though it's a pretty, you know, you guys, a perv and a peeping Tom and all that, but he's a likable guy, and I think the claustrophobia aspect of it just really, you know, it gives you some, even though that is over the top, like you said, especially the way the camera tilts and everything, it's just, I don't know, I'm in complete agreement with you. I find myself conflicted in a way still, because, you know, is he paying homage to Alfred Hitchcock, or is he just, I don't know, because you've got that circular kiss with Wasson and Deborah Shelton, you know,
as the camera is swirling around,
which repeats itself later on, with Melanie Griffith, who's like almost like the modern day equivalent of Kim Novak in Vertigo, you know, the same kind of hair.
And Melanie Griffith normally kind of gets on my nerves, but I liked her in this movie.
I know. I mean, you know, what happened to the days when Melanie Griffith was hot? I mean, you know, this and Working Girl, and I don't know. I still think that she's capable of turning in a good performance, but she's become Melanie Griffith, if that makes any sense.
I wish I could sit down with Brian De Palma and just ask him a few questions, because I don't know, I guess I'm sort of fascinated by him in some weird way, because about a month ago I went to see The Black Dahlia.
Right.
Which has a lot of, there are a lot of similarities. There's a lot of stuff that's just like way over the top, just out of the blue.
Right.
And I'm like, the guy's competent. This obviously has to be intentional, you know, but why?
You know, it's funny you mention that, because, you know, I love this podcast out of Chicago, filmspotting.net, and, you know, they mentioned the same thing. It's like, you know, could it be a parody that we're not in on? So, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe the guy's doing black comedy or satire, and he just wants it to, I don't know. It's weird. It's very strange.
I don't know. Unfortunately, there's not a commentary, but there are four featurettes.
Good featurettes.
Covering, let's see what they called, The Seduction, The Setup, The Mystery, and The Controversy.
And it takes you through all aspects of the film.
And, excuse me, and really, with this, you don't need a commentary, because they pretty much cover, I think, most of the stuff you want to know.
And some really good stories there. One thing that I thought was very touching, in a way, is a part of, I think it's the second or third featurette, where Melanie Griffith is talking about the scene where she kind of got nude. Well, not kind of, she gets nude. And De Palma's kind of like looking up at the ceiling and everything, and just, you know... And the guy's taking a lot of heat for, you know, nudity in his movies. But, you know, she said that he couldn't be more of a gentleman, and he's just great to work with, very sensitive in situations like that. And she thought it was very sweet. So I thought that was a really good tale, behind-the-scenes tale. And Deborah Shelton, boy, she's aged really well, huh? Yeah, she looks great. And I was fascinated by her insights into the film, since it was like her first really big role. And Greg Henry, does Greg Henry ever get old?
I don't think so.
He looks fantastic. I mean, he's got a picture of Dorian Gray in his basement or something, but just, and I'll tell you, two surprises that we have to talk about here. How about Dennis Franz, I'm sorry, just out of the blue, I didn't expect him to be in this movie, and I saw this movie a long time ago on video, but just, I couldn't recall his role, so it was a surprise to see him, and he's great.
Uh-huh. As he pretty much says, playing Brian De Palma.
Yeah, exactly, and maybe even a future look at Andy Sipowicz in a way, you know, because he's has the same kind of gruff exterior, you know. And also, what about Frankie Goes to Hollywood? I thought that I had accidentally put the TV button on my remote on and I was watching VH1 Classic.
I had completely forgotten about that scene, but I love it. But I'm a sucker for the 80s.
Yeah.
And this movie is very 1984.
Right.
Not Orwell 84, but no. In terms of the year it was released.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. I think maybe that has something to do with my fondness for it.
But just, I don't know what it is. It's another one of those guilty pleasure discs.
It's not for everybody. A lot of people are going to hate it, and I would certainly understand why.
But if you can look at it from our perspective, unintentional satire. Maybe that's the way De Palma wanted it to be, and you know, some people just aren't in on
it's
the joke.
It's entertaining enough, and it gets you thinking, like we're thinking right now, and anything like that I think I would recommend.
Yeah, so definitely a film you need to check out. Matter of fact, De Palma says that the films that most people come up to him and talk about are Scarface, Big Surprise, and Body Double. So if you want to see one of De Palma's best films in terms of his following, this is definitely the way to go. And it's a good-looking disc. I mean, the transfer was simply fantastic. It looks like it just came out yesterday, so... Body Double in a brand new special edition from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment, Inc. Okay, folks, we're going to take a break here. We're going to break from the usual format here and just kind of say hi and talk about a few things while we've got an opportunity to. We kind of had an unintentional hiatus due to a few various reasons, which we won't bore you to tears with. But one thing I did want to talk about is my co-host, Stan Williams, received a very special honor recently. Stan, would you like to elaborate on that and tell the folks the good news?
Okay. Not the biggest self-promoter in the world. We did here recently win the... I don't want to talk about it. I can't talk.
Stan won the top honor at the Rocket City Film Festival's Short Film Entry Division for his film, The Assassinator.
The Assassinator.
And thank you. Thank you very much. Fake applause, but anyway, enough about that.
I wonder what applause from the future would sound like.
Yeah, it would sound like... Yeah, it's okay. But anyway, Stan, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So proud to be a part of that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And it's available on your MySpace page.
Which is myspace.com/TheRealStanWilliams.
Right.
Or you can also view it at myspace.com/TheAssassinator.
Okay. And we'll also put a link on the DVD marquee site as well as our own MySpace page. And speaking of which, we now, like the cool kids... We now have a MySpace page of our own. It's still kind of in the development process. It's not much to look at, but just you can access it at myspace.com/... You guys know what to do. myspace.com/TheDVDMarquee. Now, this is really going to come in handy, folks, because starting effective immediately... As of this program, I will be updating the blog on that particular site. Man, I'll be giving you reviews of titles that we don't have time to cover here on the show and other things, other musings going on, like what I think about current films, television, music, and so on. And we'll try and get Stan and Shane and JM to contribute as well. And we're really excited about it, and we'd also like to hear your comments there. And you know, Stan, it didn't take very long for somebody to respond to our request for listener mail, and this is at our Gmail address. We also have a Gmail address, thedvdmarquee@gmail.com, and I would like to read this listener letter from Jason Bargo, who says, Hey, Jeff and Stan. I just had a comment about Mission Impossible 3. There are a lot of people who really, really, really don't like the first film for various reasons, but I continually find it to be the most fun and intriguing in the series. Maybe it's just me being cynical in my old age. I'm 27. I've got a few years on you, buddy. But action films have to do a whole lot to impress me. The effects in MI3 are pedestrian and over the top, while parts of the film that should be expanded upon, like Philip Seymour Hoffman, are left on the wayside. Well, I can agree with that latter statement. One of the charms for me about the first film is all the disguises and machinations, I think, is of the plot. Okay. Did I get that word right? Okay.
You were in the ballpark.
I'm in the ballpark. Okay. I tried, folks. Machinations.
I love the opening sequence and the use of the burning string. For the life of me, I can't remember what it's called right now. The fuse. The idea that Ethan didn't know who to trust was excellent, and every action set piece didn't feel like an action set piece. In MI3, the set pieces are involved, complex, and ultimately boring. I didn't feel anything watching this film. Maybe it was my fault seeing this the week after watching perhaps the best film of the year, United 93.
Exactly.
I agree J.J. Abrams tried to do something new and fresh with the franchise, but was the original TV show ever about explosions? I don't think so.
No.
It was about stealth. I can't get into action films today. I watched Escape from New York for the first time the other night. Boring and horribly dated.
I don't know about that. I kind of like that movie.
Give me
myself
a good drama any day of the week. I think I'm one of the few people in the world who didn't like X-Men The Last Stand and completely abhorred Pirates 2.
Stan's turning red, by the way, Jason.
No, I'm not. Oh, yeah, how dare anybody have a conflicting opinion, opinion that conflicts with my own. Honestly, first time I saw Pirates 2, wasn't that crazy about it?
Okay. See, Jason, you just need to go back and see it four more times like Stan has.
Both were action for action's sake instead of putting the characters and story first. And the less it is said about the abomination that is MI2, the better. Regardless,
even Thandie Newton? Oh, sorry.
Regardless, still love the podcast, and I agree with Stan. You guys have to find some DVDs that are terrible movies. You shouldn't always be agreeing everything is great. Signed, Jason.
Jason, okay. Thank you very much. And by the way, he has a blog, if I may plug that here. It is jj79.livejournal.com, home of Digital Joe movie and DVD reviews. HTTP, you know all the rest, folks. www.dvdtown.com. Digital Joe. I wonder if that's a follow-up to Average Joe. But anyway.
Oh, thanks for the letter. It's nice.
Yeah, we really do.
Nice,
we wish we had time
feedback
to read a couple more here, but just, folks, we really would love to hear your comments about the podcast, pro or con, at either our new MySpace site / the DVD marquee, or at Gmail, or the DVD marquee at gmail.com. Need a cue card guy. See if we can get it in the budget to hire somebody for that. But anyway, we do appreciate your comments.
I think Jason's got some valid points there.
I do too. I mean, you know, some things I don't agree with, but just it was a pleasure hearing from him.
But he's right though. I mean, maybe hell. I mean, just thinking about Pirates of the Caribbean 2. Yeah, the first time I saw it, I realized this is all over the place, and it was one of those movies I thought, I don't know. I'll see it again. I did like it better the second time, but that was with very different expectations. And I wonder myself, it's like, well, am I being too lenient, you know, when I change my expectations on something like that?
You know, I felt the same way about Die Hard with a Vengeance. You know, I didn't really like it the first time I saw it, and then started playing on cable, and then I got the DVD, and now it's one of my favorite movies. So it's interesting how your opinion can change. You know, and there's a lot to be said about expectations and stuff like that. But, you know, I haven't seen it yet myself. I haven't seen Dead Man's Chest, but we're pretty 99.9% confident we're going to be getting the DVD copy of it, so it'll be interesting to hear my take on it, because it's gotten a lot of mixed reviews. Very surprising, considering how popular the first one was, but I think maybe, like you said, expectations were so high that a lot of people were bound to be disappointed. But anyway,
everybody approaches these things from a different viewpoint,
right? And it would be very boring if
maybe
we were all
alike. I don't remember exactly what I said about MI3, but thinking back on it, I'm like, I didn't think it was really all that great of a movie, but maybe I was grading it on terms, you know, maybe because I thought there was one or two little things that it did get right that right. a lot of movies don't seem to get right these days. But I don't know. Again, Jason, thanks for the email. Love debating this stuff with people.
Yeah, right back at you, Dan. And again, folks, write us and let us know what you think about the show. And now, back to more movies.
You wouldn't believe it. One night I got in jail in Starkville, Mississippi for picking flowers. I was walking down the street. I may sing that for you a little bit later on. I was walking down the street. What? Excuse me, I couldn't hear you. I was talking. I was walking down the street and, you know, going to get me some cigarettes or something. About 2 o'clock in the morning after a show, I think it was. Anyway, I reached down and picked a dandelion here and a daisy there as I went along, and this car pulls up. I said, get it the hell in here, boy. What are you doing? I said, I'm just picking flowers. Well, $36 for picking flowers in a night in jail. God damn. You can't hardly win, can you? Damn. No telling what you'd do if you'd pull an apple or something.
It is hard to believe that it has been a year since the biopic Walk the Line came out, chronicling the life of Johnny Cash, or the early life of Johnny Cash, up until the 1968 concert, an historic concert, I might add, at Folsom Prison. And it's even harder to believe that it's been 3 years since Johnny left us mere mortals on this planet. But his music, ironically, like his former fellow Sun recording artist Elvis Presley, has grown more popular since his death, and it may arguably be even more popular than it was in his lifetime. For example, this summer, his latest collaboration, or one of his final collaborations with producer Rick Rubin, American Recordings Volume 5, debuted at number 1 in its first week on the Billboard charts. 50 years have gone by since Johnny Cash recorded some of his most legendary recordings for Sun Records, including I Walk the Line, Folsom Prison, and many, many others too numerous to mention. And his second label, Columbia Records, a.k.a. Sony nowadays, Sony Music, or the legacy subsidiary of Sony Records, has just released a fantastic 3-disc edition of his legendary 1969 follow-up to the Folsom Prison album, Johnny Cash at San Quentin. Now, why are we talking about a musical set? Well, this is where DVD comes in. For the very first time, I had a chance to experience the long-heralded 1969 documentary that was shot at the same time of the recording of the live album, Johnny Cash in San Quentin. It's a 50-minute overview, a documentary shot for British television that includes parts of that legendary concert and also comments from the prisoners and guards at San Quentin at the time. Stan, I know you're a huge Johnny Cash fan as well. What mm-hmm. kind of effect did this really little scene documentary have on you?
I enjoyed it. Obviously, big Johnny Cash fan. Actually, I really wish for a little more Johnny Cash and a little less interviewing and a little less prison documentary.
It's a little jarring when you go back and forth like they do, and it's kind of disjointing, but I admired it for talking to the prisoners and the guards. Mm-hmm. You get a good sense of what Johnny Cash sees in these men.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I think
you definitely do.
And the thing is, the thing that I've always loved about Johnny Cash is that he's sane to everybody. He didn't seem to have any kind of discrimination toward anyone. I think he was happy, perhaps even happier, singing to men like this than he was singing for presidents at the White House. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've always loved about him, you know, is his Christianity, but not to the point where it offended people. You know, if you look into the Bible, you know, Jesus hung with everybody from, you know, the rich to the downtrodden. And, you know, I think, you know, I it's a trait that I admired so much about Johnny. And, you know, it's really something that saved his life, along with June Carter Cash. A little back history for you guys out here. back around 1963, between 1963 and 1967, Johnny's career kind of took a turn for the worse because he was arrested numerous times on drug charges, and he was the first citizen to ever be sued by the U.S. government for starting a forest fire. And he was practically a real hellraiser, and just really didn't care, you know, what he did, or, you know, kicked the footlights out at the Grand Ole Opry, a big no-no. They kicked him off the Opry for that. But in 1967, he was fortunate enough to be discovered. He was in a cave around Chattanooga, Tennessee, and his mother and June Carter found him and basically saved his life because he wanted to go in there and basically die. He just felt that he was at the end of his rope and just didn't have anything to offer. So, you know, he got himself cleaned up, didn't need any kind of detox or anything like that. He did it like a man. He got off strictly on his own and then got together with a guy named Bob Johnson over at CBS Records. Bob took over the Nashville division, talked to Johnny and said, "Johnny, what do you want to do?" And Johnny says, "Well, I've always wanted to record a live album in prisons because I feel very comfortable around those men." And he did the Folsom Prison album, one of the biggest albums of the 1960s, one of the few country records during that decade to make a significant impact. And it inspired this project at San Quentin, which we're talking about right now. And it's just simply, I cannot say enough words about this. Not only do you get the DVD of the documentary, you also get a two-disc set, which pretty much gathers together all the existing recordings from that historic day, from the opening acts, the great Carl Perkins, Gene Carter, the Carter family with Mother Maybelle, the Statler brothers, and then Johnny himself. And it's just really something special. I don't know if you've heard the album yet, Stan. This is kind of a late addition to our show here, but I just really, you know, I'm such a big fan, I wanted to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But just it's a terrific album. And let me play you a piece of this album right here that shows you the great rapport that Johnny had with audiences at Folsom Prison and San Quentin. Check this out.
I tell you what, the show is being recorded and televised for England. And they told me, you got to do this song, you got to do that song, you know, you got to stand like this or act like this. I just don't get it, man. You know, I'm here to do what you want me to and what I want to do. Right? Okay. So what do you want to hear? All right. I walked the line.
And of course, this classic album served as a launching point for one of Johnny's memorable singles, the 1969 number two smash, A Boy Named Sue.
Well, my daddy left home when I was three, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.
It sounds great. You know, the documentary, I was kind of disappointed they didn't clean it up very much because it's in pretty horrible shape.
Yeah, I was a little surprised at how beat up it still looks.
And the thing is that, you know, we're not asking for a Gone with the Wind type restoration.
In a way, though, I kind of like that. You know, in a way, it kind of made it give it more of an authentic feel of the period.
True. And by the way, you actually get to hear the entire performance of A Boy Named Sue on this particular DVD. The other ones that I can recall offhand, you've got the Orange Blossom Special. You've got, Peace in the Valley, which just makes me want to cry every time I hear it. And, you know, there's also a 40-page booklet full of rare photos taken that day, including the infamous Who's Number One shot that you see a lot of kids wearing on t-shirts nowadays. It's just a classic photo, and nobody really has the story right of what inspired Johnny to kind of flip the camera guy off. They don't know if it was a security guard or if it was one of the people that were on the documentary crew while they were doing rehearsals. But, you know, you get thoughts from the great Merle Haggard, who actually saw Johnny at San Quentin in 1959. Merle did a little time for some robbery, and that performance changed his life. And, you know, Stan, I'd like to think that when Johnny appeared there in 1969 for the recording of this album and the documentary, that it changed a few lives, a few of those prisoners' lives as well.
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did.
And the thing is, we find ourselves humbled, at least I do, talking about this, and there's really not much more that I can add except to say thank you so much for the folks at Sony and Legacy for letting us have this. And we really want to do more musical things on this show, and I hope that we'll get an opportunity to, because that's like my first love, in addition to movies being a very close second. So if you're looking for a great Christmas gift for a die-hard Johnny Cash fan, you can't go wrong with this three-disc edition of Johnny Cash at San Quentin from Sony and Legacy. Great stuff.
I'm hereby sentencing you to community service. You're gonna fix the road under my supervision.
What? This place is crazy!
So we're gonna hitch you up to Sweet Bessie and you're gonna pull her nice.
You gotta be kidding me.
You start there where the road begins. You finish down there where the road ends.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! How long is this gonna take?
Well, fella does it right, should take him about 5 days.
5 days? But I should be in California schmoozing Dinoco right now.
Then if I were you, I'd quit yapping and start working. Hook him up, Mater.
Okie dokie.
Freedom!
Maybe I should have hooked him up to Bessie and then took the boot off.
Okay, with apologies to our Canadian friends Shane and Jeff Reynolds, we're going to have to give another plug to Walt Disney and Pixar's amazing Cars, which is one of my favorite films of the year. I don't think we can do as great a job as they did talking about this film, but we definitely wanted to talk about the extras, especially the mini documentary that John Lasseter had on this thing, Inspiration for Cars. Did you take a look at that, Stan?
Yeah, I did. I really enjoyed that. That was one of the, it's one of those documentaries, I think it was, what, about 16 minutes long?
It was just 16 minutes, and man, don't you wish it were longer?
It was, and that's always a sign of a good documentary. I really liked it. It was about, basically about Route 66.
Right.
A bit about the history and a little bit of John Lasseter talking about trips he would take as a kid, and ties in with the movie really well. And it's interesting. You meet some interesting people along the way, and I'd like to see a whole movie, a whole documentary.
They're probably saving it for the obligatory two-disc follow-up, which will probably come in about a year from right now. But the one thing that really touched me about that, in addition to meeting these fascinating people, especially the barber in that small Arizona town, was the fact that John Lasseter was just at the top of his game around the era of Toy Story and Toy Story 2. And it was really, you know, sometimes you have to make sacrifices you don't really want to make. And it was like he wasn't spending as much time with his family, and they all decided to get into this used camper and travel cross country. And it was just very inspiring. It said that his family got closer as a result, and I just I tipped my hat off to him. It just sounded like a really life-changing experience, and also added tremendously to the visuals and effects of this film. Another thing I liked, I wish this would have a commentary, but again, that's probably going to be saved for the two-disc backseat edition, I'd probably call it. Anyway, other things on it, one-man band, which was also in the theater, if I remember correctly, very cute little short. What'd you think about Mater and the Ghost Light?
It was cute. Nothing major, but it was okay.
You know, Shane and JM just absolutely, you know, praised it. And I think maybe it kind of, I had my hopes up a little too high for it. But I thought it was cute, and it was great to have all the other of the original cast members back doing the voices for that. And the deleted scenes, not really great, but there's a couple of scenes that were interesting in terms of the way they expanded upon them or treated them differently in the film. And, you know, it's not a very features-loaded disc, but I just had to give props to the inspiration for Carla's documentary. And this is just, this, would you believe, and I don't know if I've got my figures right, but I think I'm pretty close. Would you believe that this DVD, I don't think we'd really need to talk about it much more, but this DVD made $245 million in the first week of release. Can you believe that? That's just simply incredible. And I think it's
those
probably...
those are like John Tucker Must Die numbers.
Yes, they... Sorry, but yeah, it's amazing. And if that doesn't prove what an effect that this movie had on people emotionally, I have to admit, I'm not a car nut, but I found myself really, I love this movie. It's just, and what about the picture quality on this disc? I mean, is this not one of the best transfers you've ever seen?
It's pretty stunning.
And it's not high definition. I mean, can you imagine what this thing is going to look in either HD or Blu-ray?
This won't come as a major shock to anyone, I think, but I don't think I like the movie quite as much as you do. To me, it seems a bit like kind of like Pixar Lite. I mean, it's all there. It's technologically incredible. The story is there, but for me, something was just lacking. It never quite clicked all the way. So I think maybe I'm getting a little tired of Owen Wilson's persona. It's starting to wear just a little thin.
But hey, what about Paul Newman?
Oh, it's freaking Paul Newman.
I mean, just amazing. And Bonnie Hunt is wonderful as well. There's not a single bad character actor doing the voices in this film. And, you know, I may be overpraising it just a bit, but just...
Would you say so far it's the best teaming of Paul Newman and Larry the Cable Guy?
I would think so. I hope they'll work together again. I hope they'll go on the road. Anyway, Cars... from Buena Vista Home Entertainment. If you haven't gotten it by now, you need to. It's a wonderful movie, and again, it's probably going to wind up not only in my top 10 films of the year, but the top 10 DVDs of 2006, although I've got my wallet ready for the two-disc edition, which I know will be coming on down the line. Okay, folks, in my opinion, I think we've saved the best for last, and I gotta put a disclaimer on here. Impartiality goes out the window when I'm talking about my musical hero, Mr. Sir Paul McCartney. One of the first memories that I have of my younger years is listening to my older brother Kenny's portable pop-up record player in my grandmother's bedroom and hearing the words of a song called Can't Buy Me Love. And when we were kids, you're fascinated by moving objects. I still remember that black vinyl spinning round and round with the multicolors around the United Artists record label, the soundtrack of A Hard Day's Night, courtesy of my sister-in-law, Donna. And I have been a Beatles fan, Paul fan, John fan, George fan, Ringo fan for going on over 40 years now. And Paul is back with a bit of positive news, given his personal troubles lately with a woman we won't mention, courtesy of the brand new A&E concert film, Paul McCartney, The Space Within Us. It's got over 20 of his both solo and Beatles classics in phenomenal 5.1, DTS 5.1, and also for you folks that still haven't upgraded to the multi-channel sound, good old-fashioned Dolby Surround. Now, Stan, I know that you and I have had our moments in talking about Paul over the years, but go ahead and give me your take on this particular concert. Now, for the benefit of those folks at home, Stan is a Beatles fan, but not to the extent that I am. So, Stan, take it away, your thoughts on this concert video.
Well, the first thing I want to say is this is a great DVD if you love Paul McCartney as much as Paul McCartney loves Paul McCartney.
Now, the thing is, I have to disagree with you here, Stan. I have to disagree with you here because Paul McCartney was not in charge of this disc. It's produced and directed by a gentleman by the name...
I just get the sense, and I'm just messing with you here.
I know you are.
I just get the sense that Paul McCartney... truly enjoys talking about Paul McCartney.
Well, the thing is, it's not just him, Stan. This is kind of this is the third concert film that he's made with this gentleman, and I know I'm butchering his name, and I'm going to apologize in advance. It's Mark Heffley.
That is actually pronounced George Lucas.
George Lucas. Okay, yeah. Let's, so you can diss George Lucas here. But anyway, it's produced
and
by...
And I'd also like to make fun of the Wayans brothers for doing Little Man while I'm at it. Okay, now I'm done.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Stan. Again, Stan's views do not represent the DVD marquee staff at Hole. Anyway, no. Back to the McCartney disc here. It's directed by a gentleman by the name of Mark Heffley. Hopefully we've got that right. But anyway, the problem that I had with his first two discs is because this guy doesn't know how to cut concert films. At least he didn't until this particular disc. No shot lasted more than maybe 4 or 5 seconds. And I've got to show you. Folks, if you really want to see how not to edit a concert film, I want you to get Paul's last disc live at Red Square for the bonus concert that was taken in another Russian city that escapes me at this time. I don't think there's any kind of shot that lasts for more than 3 seconds. And it firstly made me sit. I couldn't watch it. I made a CDR of the songs.
So it's the concert equivalent of Michael Bay's Armageddon.
Pretty much. Yeah. You got it right on the money, man. Exactly. But this time, I think he actually focuses on band members playing, you know, more than a single note. And I don't know what you thought about the cutting of this. And, of course, you know, it's a tribute to Paul. You know, you've got a lot of talking heads here from author Bob Spitz, who wrote a terrific biography of the Beatles, which is now in paperback, by the way. And paperback writer. Anyway, and you've got Sir William Jefferson. A matter of fact, speaking of the former head of the U.S. of A., let's hear what he's got to say about Paul McCartney.
He's an American icon. He means something to us, and we feel like that we have at least a small claim on him. I was in the Staples Center in Los Angeles when he sang, and it was amazing. The whole generation of young people, virtually everybody in the audience was much younger than me, and they were just as into it as I was.
So, yeah, I know. I can see your point where, you know, a lot of the talking heads kind of interrupted. Did you feel that they interrupted the flow of the concert? Would you have preferred to have seen, like, a straight concert film?
I think I would have. But it didn't, I mean, it didn't bother me that, you know, that much.
But I tell you, I particularly enjoyed hearing from the musical professors who talked about, you know, the effects of music as a healing force. And I can honestly say, without trepidation, that the music of Paul McCartney and the Beatles have gotten me through a lot of really tough times in my life. And it's just inspiring, you know, when you look out. Now, a lot of people have done complaining about Paul's concert films as of late having too many reaction shots of the audience. But you know something? That's half the fun of going to a show like this. I mean, it's just amazing. He affects everybody from, like, you know, people that grew up with the Beatles, you know, who were basically in their late teens and early 20s back in the mid-1960s.
Everybody from those who really, really, really love Paul McCartney to those who just really, really love him.
It's inspiring to see what he's still doing at his age, and I hope he never stops. But I gotta ask you what you thought as far as the music in the film. Did you find a lot of great songs that, you know, brought back some memories?
Oh yeah, it's fun.
You?
I mean, it's friggin' Paul McCartney. You know, I mean, I have no criticism of it. Really, really, one way or the other, it's fine. Especially, you know, if you're a Paul McCartney fan, I think you'll really dig it. Even if you're not, you know, it's pretty enjoyable.
And one thing that I think I need to point out for longtime fans that may have had some criticisms of the other DVDs, you actually get complete songs here, only with a couple of exceptions. Let It Be and Hey Jude are kind of abbreviated with documentary stuff over them, but they've been featured to death on his other concert discs, so that's not really that big of a deal for me. But it's a refreshing change. A lot of the songs are complete. There's not as many TNA shots as there were in the last couple of films, but I'm having a problem with that, but that's another story. The extras on the disc are surprisingly plentiful for a single disc. You've got soundcheck songs. And by the way, Paul doesn't do the usual soundcheck. He likes to do kind of like a different type of show. And he does the old Jerry Lee Lewis song, Whole Lot of Shaking Going On, and a couple of songs from the terrific Chaos and Creation in the Backyard album, Friends to Go, which was inspired by George Harrison, by the way, and How Kind of You, which I just found out from a good friend of mine, Jory Grayson, was written about Linda McCartney. So it's, both of them are terrific songs, and I'm glad that they're represented here. You've also got More About Us, interviews with Paul McCartney, the band, and the U.S. tour crew. And it just amazes me just how much work that they put into setting up a show like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, just one thing I can say about Paul McCartney is that I have never heard bad sound at one of his shows. I mean, he's just a perfectionist, and his crew follows in suit. One thing I'm really glad they included was the pre-tour film. It's about 10 minutes long. It's kind of like a mini history of Paul McCartney from his early days in Liverpool as a child to the present day. There's some neat footage of the Beatles. I don't know if you had a chance to see this particular segment, Stan.
Yeah.
You had like the footage of all four of the Beatles posing for photographs in 1968. That was a real treat.
I thought it was a nice little inclusion.
Definitely. And just probably one of the last few times they actually got along. But then again, another story. There's a terrific multi-page book with liner notes by Cameron Crowe and some of Paul's favorite moments or memories from the tour. And if you're a Paul McCartney fan, this is just, or a Beatles fan, this is just a must for your collection. And it's probably going to get my vote as the concert film of the year. And it's the best one he's ever put out. So I cannot find enough to say about Paul McCartney, The Space Within Us, now available courtesy of A&E Home Video. And folks, I believe we're out of DVDs. Actually, we're not out of DVDs, if only you could see what you're not seeing. But Stan, thank you again. It's been a pleasure to have you along, as always.
Thank you, Jeff. Always a pleasure.
And folks, again, please let us know what you think about our show at either our new MySpace page, myspace.com/thedvdmarquee, or via our regular email address, which is thedvdmarquee@gmail.com. Now, our next show, I'm really excited about this. I don't know if you are, because I don't think you liked the film as much as I did. Shane and Jeff Reynolds, next week, will be having a review of the brand new 2-disc Superman Returns DVD. And there's one other film that they, a big new release title, but I can't for the life of me remember what it is, but it's going to be smashing. Just take my word for it. I'm also hoping that they'll be able to throw in a few comments about the Christopher Reeve collection, which is going to feature all the Superman movies, including the long wanted, requested, what have you, Richard Donner cut of Superman 2, which were, I think, safe to say that you're jazzed about that as I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Although still the first one's my favorite. I mean, there's no, just Superman, the movie, still one of my favorite movies of all time. So looking forward to that. Again, we can't say enough about thehometheaterforum.com. We appreciate their ongoing sponsorship and report. And the same goes to Shane's site, iCraveDVD.com. Visit both of those sites, and I guarantee you, you'll be busy for hours, particularly now since we've got like a flood of titles coming in. Anyway, for the DVD Marquee, my good friend Stan Williams, this is Jeffrey Rosato. By the way, folks, since this will probably be our last show before Thanksgiving, have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. And before I forget, we lost yet another great actor recently, and the second actor in the past few months to pass away that was a part of one of our favorite films of the early 90s, City Slickers, the wonderful Jack Palance. And right now, we'd like to remember him with a wonderful scene from that film with Billy Crystal. Until next time, everybody.
See them tumbling down, pledging their love to the ground. Lonely but free I'll be found, drifting along with the tumbling tumbleweeds. Cares of the past are behind, no way to go but I'll find just where the trail will wind. Drifting along with the tumbling tumbleweeds.
You know any show tunes?